Hi there, and welcome to our podcast, Mindfulness at Work. I'm Cara Pollard.
Welcome, everyone. It's so good to be here at Mindfulness at Work with two extraordinarily mindful people. I am here today, and my guests are Laura Berland and Evan Harrell. And they are, Laura is the executive director and founder for the Center for Compassionate Leadership. And Evan is the COO. And they are a nonprofit organization and they have five part-time employees. And their services are so needed currently in the corporate setting and in our world. So welcome, Laura and Evan. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Cara.
Thank you, Cara.
So why don't you tell us exactly what the Center for Compassionate Leadership does, and maybe even the story from the beginning, how you came to want to found it, Laura, and then what you do and how you serve communities.
Lovely. And just a moment of gratitude to share our work and our perspective with your audience. You know, our mission is really to help build more compassion in the world. We focus on leaders because we see them as an important point of leverage to help grow the ripples of compassion and mindfulness throughout. So the focus of the center is really to bring together the wisdom of business experience and leadership that we all know is important, to let go of the parts of traditional leadership that have been obstacles to the flourishing of many people and many organizations. And that's become, you know, incredibly apparent during this time of COVID pandemic, cultural unrest, political upheaval, mm-hmm. etc. And to meld the best practices in organizational behavior and business with the wisdom that comes from so many contemplative cultures and indigenous cultures that we know fuels the human thriving and enables us to be aware and mindful of what we're doing. And then the last piece of what our fabric has woven together really includes all the beautiful science and the research that is coming forth over the last about 20 years and continues to multiply and amplify, that is confirming everything ancient cultures have already known about how humans really connect, come together, create safety and belonging. And those are values that we need to bring into organizations and frankly into life so that we can all be happy, healthy humans. So that's the goal of the center. Mm-hmm. The impetus for bringing this forward a couple of years ago was really the culmination of my 40 years in organizational life, both as an entrepreneur in large corporate environments, and also several decades of a contemplative life as a meditation teacher, as a yoga instructor, and as a trainer of trainers, and melding together what seemed to be two separate parts of my life. Mm-hmm. But as my mindful practice and as my contemplative practices grew, they really made a difference in my whole life, in my family life, in my business life. So the idea to put them all together under one umbrella, if you will, it just, frankly, some of it was sparked in 2016 by the political upheaval in the United States. Mm-hmm. And then some of it was just my personal need to align,
yes,
my values with my day-to-day work. And I was doing fabulous, wonderful organizational work. It just wasn't deep enough. It didn't really go to the heart. And mm-hmm. I needed to move my whole life from the head to the heart.
Well, that is just beautiful. I really appreciate you kind of taking us through and threading that. It sounds to me like your organizational work was almost in contrast to your contemplative work. And so it was hard. And I just did a presentation and I opened it with Gandhi's quote that, you know, so many people come to me and say, I just want to be happy. And so Gandhi's quote that happiness is when what you say, what you think, and what you do are all in harmony, I think is kind of reminds me of what happened to you when it's not harmonious. People say, how can I attain balance, work-life balance or life-work balance, whatever order you want to put it in. Well, you can attain balance if what you say, what you think, and what you do are not in harmony. That in and of itself is harmony is balance. So I appreciate that. Laura, I do have a question because I'm so interested in when you say like you took a lot of things that were inherent in ancient cultures that were wisdom-driven ways that people learned that from the human beings need to connect. It was in contrast with what we set up in corporate America, certainly organizationally. Can you give me an example just so that we can get our, you know, head around what you mean by that? Like what a form of ancient culture that just had connectedness at the forefront as opposed to how we create an organization and how we go about that?
Yeah. So it's so interesting that you said, can we put our heads around it? Because what I immediately thought about was, can we put our hearts around it? Mm-hmm. And we can look across all contemplative cultures, religious traditions, indigenous cultures. We all come back to the same. We often talk about multiple paths, one, you know, like we're all going to the same place, which is just to have this deep, rich experience of heart-to-heart connection with another human being. And when we look at what the science is now telling us, that really was the critical component of how we survived as a species. Mm-hmm. Not competing, mm-hmm. but connecting, supporting, nurturing, growing, flourishing as connected humans, connected communities, and frankly, being in connection with our planet, with nature. We are not separate from that. So one of the strongest examples is exactly in the sweet spot of this conversation, which is mindfulness, mm-hmm. that innate awareness that we have, but we need to cultivate. It's not a skill that, in compassion as well, these are innate skills. We just need to get all the stuff out of the way so we can see clearly,
yes.
and make decisions that are also, yes, we need our prefrontal cortex. We need to make executive decisions, but they need to be informed by the wholeness of our being, which is not just us as separate beings. It's also this connection that we have to others. There really yes. is no space between us.
Yeah, that's a very hard concept, just I think for your average person to grasp, but in my teaching of work-life balance, which is really work-life integration, there is no balance or nothing is really balanced 50% of the time. So I'm using the word integration. And Evan, when I use the word integration, I think that we were having it a little bit backwards where we wanted to kind of separate ourselves and we're almost divisive within ourselves as to who we were as a parent or a family member and to who we were as an employee. And therefore that divisiveness doesn't work because divisiveness doesn't work. So we would try to segregate ourselves as a whole person. So I'm trying to teach that if you're feeling successful in one area, that might overflow to the other and vice versa. If you're feeling like a failure or if you're stressed out, you're going to bring that feeling into the other environment. So I think that if we start with the whole, hey, who am I as a whole person? What's important to me? And we bring those to the various silos and aspects of our life, that would be a much better way to go about it. And we would feel that harmony that Gandhi talks about. Can you add to that, Evan, in a very, I know you have a very beautiful way of articulating that.
Well, I'll certainly try. I think that one of the things that is an important principle for us at the Center for Compassion Leadership is that any of the transformation that we're discussing starts with the self. We have to begin with the recognition that we ourselves are living, breathing beings worthy of being here and worthy to celebrate the fact that we are here. And until we are able to fully reconcile just being here with the outside world, it will be hard for us to move within the outside world because we will spend so much time thinking, am I able to justify myself relative to that benchmark out there or what that person thinks over there? So we start with ourselves and get comfortable with ourselves in all of our complete self, the good, the complicated, the messy, the times we make mistakes, recognizing that that's just part of what it means to be a human. And instead of trying to achieve perfection, we start from the point of recognizing that each moment we have another breath and we don't even know where that breath came from, where that life coursing through us came from, that we should be celebrating and accepting that gift and then begin to turn outside and recognize that it's the same out there.
Yes.
When we can do that, it's a little easier, I think, to then begin to transcend the competition that Laura was just describing, which is a major hurdle to compassion. We can begin to recognize that we don't have to beat someone else, to out-achieve someone else in order to celebrate each moment as it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really beautiful. I do think that, and I often talk about how we derail ourselves by our thoughts. So, and much of it is based in competition rather than cooperation. So we often measure ourselves against someone else's values, which again is not harmonious. So that if we're looking at what someone else thinks is important, we're going to be out of whack. And then we say things to ourselves like, you idiot, you didn't achieve what you were supposed to achieve, or you didn't make that benchmark, as opposed to, huh, wow, why did I just feel that way? Or why did I just say that? Being curious with ourselves. So I'd love for you to talk about self-compassion, because sometimes people just think self-compassion is, oh, just talk to yourself like you would a friend. That's a very basic, I think it's a wonderful definition, but I'd like, Evan, for you to take it a little deeper and explain it a little better.
So before I do, I just okay. want to comment on what you just said about measuring ourselves against other people. How many times, I will just ask this myself, how many times have I gone off chasing after something that I thought I needed because somebody else had it or because someone else had done it? And I really didn't care that much about it. I'd spent all this time and all this energy in pursuit of something that I thought I needed because of that competitive instinct that was really, had I been more mindful of my own needs and what I really needed and wanted and be aligned and complete as you just described, I'd be spending my time in pursuit of those things that will really allow me to flourish.
Beautiful.
So compassion is an interesting concept because compassion is by definition a relational term. It's about how we are with each other, mm-hmm. with people in their experiences. So self-compassion is a little bit tricky because it's just me. So self-compassion requires us to have enough of a mindful sense to be able to just move slightly outside of ourselves and just be able to observe our thoughts and observe our feelings without getting all caught up in them. And one of the practices we use, and it's a very, very well known and popular practice, is that we will have people who are upset in a situation, write a note to put someone else's name in it and write them a note as how you would write a note to them if someone else, your friend, was in the same situation. And then take their name out and put your own name there and read that note to yourself. And you can find yourself much more easily able to offer self-kindness when you view it in that context of being in relationship and being in relationship with yourself. And that self-kindness can be such a tricky aspect of self-compassion because of the need to be able to just pause for one moment and move yourself far enough away from your thoughts and emotions to then get into a loving, kind relationship with yourself.
Yes.
I would just love to build on that for a second, which is that we often find that the people who are most successful in life and who have this drive and this initiative to succeed in the traditional measures of our modern world have the most trouble turning toward themselves and giving themselves the space and the love that's necessary to honor the internal needs and to start at that place. So people who exhibit extraordinary compassion to others will deplete and burn themselves out because they somehow feel they're not worthy of the attention and the love and the care that they would give outside of themselves to their team, to their community, to their family, to all the interactions that they have outside of their own internal desires and needs.
Yeah, I think that somewhere along the line, they really got the message wrong. That in order to be a caring person, you can't give that care to yourself. I think that they think that would be egotistic. And actually, the ego is tricky. And I think the ego is telling them not to say something nice to themselves, because I do this work all the time. And I can tell you the people that I ask, you know, at the end of the day, instead of lying in bed and thinking of all the things you didn't do on your to-do list, can you give yourself a win? And or can you tell me one rock star moment that you had as a parent this week? And they come back and they just say, I just can't. And I'm heartbroken. I'm really heartbroken for them. And then months later, they might call me and say, you know, my child has no self-esteem. And even though I try to explain energy, right? Because even though you don't go around saying, hey, what a rock star win, although you could as a mom, I'd love to hear mom say, hey, that was great. What a rock star win you just did. But they know energetically that you're not saying that was a win, and that you might be saying you should have done more, you could have done that better, you can't say something nice to yourself. And, you know, I think that energy, I heard Dr. Kristen Neff, who is very big in self-compassion, once say something like, would you want to go to war with someone who's, you know, in the hole with you, who's saying to themselves, you idiot, you're a loser, you're afraid, you'll never be able to win this, or, you know, and that goes for anything. Do you want to be, would you want your partner at work? Would you want your partner as a parent to be saying these negative things to themselves? Or do you want someone who really feels capable and has autonomy and accountability to be a successful person? And so you'd want somebody saying those things. But I think with the busyness of life, sometimes we're so unaware of who we are. Another one of my mentors, Dr. Alexandra Solomon, asks, what would you do on a date with yourself? Well, that's another question I ask my clients, and many of them don't even know what they want for dinner. They're so beaten down that they can't even answer. They say to me, I don't know why I eat chicken every night. So then I have to work with them on why do you choose chicken? You know, should you keep it or leave it? And so it's because we're so busy that we've abandoned ourselves so often and so much. And it's so sad because really those thoughts, who we are, that self-compassion all start with how are you ever going to be a leader and how are you ever going to have, you know, compassion for the world?
And you know, it's so interesting because it's true with both compassion and self-compassion, is that many people feel like self-compassion is indulgent, and it's not. First off, it is accepting. It is allowing yourself to be exactly who you are. It's not about eating bonbons or other things.
Right.
Like that, although sometimes you do need
a bubble bath.
but it's about giving yourself what you need. And compassion is about giving the other what they need, which sometimes is firmness, is boundaries. People need both boundaries and freedom. And compassion isn't about no boundaries. Compassion is about knowing where to be so that you will be in alignment, be fulfilled. And leadership, compassionate leadership, is about creating the culture and the environments where people can thrive and flourish with freedom because they know where the limits are, what the expectations are, why they're there. And yes. It's not indulgent at all.
No, and that's so true. I used a Brené Brown quote that kind of says boundaries are about having the courage to say no, even at the risk of disappointing someone else. And I actually, I think she's a genius and I'm sure she went into this more, but I kind of expanded upon that and said, it's a momentary disappointment. It's not a disappointment for the long term. It's a really in the moment little disappointment, but you're coming to someone else as your full self so that you don't end up with years, whether you're a leader in the house or a leader at work, of unanswered boundaries and unclear boundaries that are only in one person's head. And so if your workplace is coming back to work and they expect you there, then let your employees know that that's the expectation so then they can make a choice, as opposed to, well, if you're not in the workplace, we're going to pass you up for a raise. We're going to, you know, give your male counterpart the raise because he doesn't have to do as much of the work at home. And so you're going to get passed up, but we're going to allow you to be at home. No, no, no. You have to make very clear that we expect you to be here at certain times because we need to have you in the office in front of us. But I think that sometimes we're not clear on those boundaries. Same thing as a parent, you know,
well, especially as a parent, because because children, I mean, it's true of leaders as well, but children especially are looking to their parents to try to figure out. They don't understand where the boundaries are. And if parents don't give children those boundaries, the children don't develop they won't eventually when they reach, you know, their teenagers, be able to have a process to develop boundaries for themselves.
Right.
And yeah, sure, children are disappointed. But like you say, it's a short-term disappointment that achieves a very, very important developmental end.
Right. And it's getting clear on those. I actually work with a lot of people who come to me because their child or teenager is in their mind smoking too much pot and that it's really affecting their grades. And so then when I drill down on that, what they really want, they say, is for them to be able to smoke pot normally. Well, are they able to or aren't they? So now you're coming to them and you kind of know that they smell like pot, but you don't want to say anything because you're thinking, well, maybe it's okay for this time, but then their grades come and you're really mad and you say you can't smoke pot. Well, which is it? You know, and so you have to get clear, or even bedtime, you know, do you want to drill down on that bedtime and create that boundary? It's going to be hard for the moment. It's going to be hard for the short term, but the benefits may outweigh that. So and it's hard. Boundary work. I'm working with a group of parents and we're really getting into it. And it's so messy and so difficult. And it's one of the hardest things I think we can do, but, and you're going to fall off the path and people aren't going to know what to expect because now suddenly you're creating boundaries. But once you fall off the path and get back on and try it out, I think you start to feel a little bit better about yourself and your relationships.
Which is the beauty of mindfulness training, because what you learn in mindfulness is just to start again and again and again with every breath, with every thought that veers off the path. This is how the mind works. We can't help that. What we can do is be aware and notice and come back to our intention. And it's so fundamental to build that skill. It is the foundation of compassion. I think it is the foundation of life, of a healthy, happy life, to be able to notice. As you said, at the end of the day, could you really notice what was positive instead of be dragged away by the mind swirl of what was negative, which is part, again, of our evolutionary conditioning, just to be alert and aware for danger, danger, danger. But it is this cultivation and practice of mindfulness that allows us to be intentional about where we want to place our focus and attention. And I love that you talk about energy, because it, attention really, you know, is where we point our finger and the energy follows.
So do you do, when you go and do some leadership training, do you start with mindfulness? Is that what you start in your trainings?
Absolutely. We work, we have developed a model around compassionate leadership that's very simple. We start with the self, we move to relationships with others, and then we talk about the interconnectedness and the greater good, the wholeness of each component in that circle of circles, and how when you start with self-compassion, it really ripples out. You can't show up in your family. You had that great example of like the parent being sort of wobbly. You know, if I'm clear and firm, it may not even take words. So much of what is communicated between humans is nonverbal. It's a beingness. So you have to stand firmly in your grounding, and mindfulness in my life of experience is the best training for making any of that happen. So that is where we start.
And you know, it's interesting because organizations actually can cultivate an organizational sense of awareness, which is a form of organizational mindfulness, if you will. And if you start with the individual, mindfulness is, and awareness is a critical managerial tool. But then if the team, if your team understands that you want to know what's going on out there, you have a choice. Do you shoot the messenger who brings in bad news, or do you say, oh, that's different from what I was expecting. What do we do now? Let's put our minds together and figure out. You can cultivate a greater sense of organizational awareness. And it follows from the choices that leaders make with their teams. Do they say to their teams, hey, you're my eyes and ears in the field. I really need to know what's going on out there. So no matter what it is, make sure you tell me. And that's a form of awareness. Or do you say, when they bring bad news, oh no.
Right.
Why, you know, that can't be. What did you do wrong? You know, what are, why did you let that happen? Then guess what? Your eyes and your ears completely shut down.
Right. What a good point, because, you know, we always talk with parents and certainly with leaders about the process. And I love this, you know, playing it safe has become something that people do. You know, I hear from executives all the time that some of the younger people in their firm, if they say, here, go to work, and they come back and say, well, I don't know what to do. because I knew how to get all straight A's because somebody showed me, you know, this is the syllabus, this is what your percentage is, but they have no imagination because they, you know, weren't taught that. They weren't taught almost executive functioning skills. They were just taught how to attain and achieve that A. So I have been working with people who have been giving rewards, like symbolically, little rewards for people who do things for the process and not the result. So somebody who might take a risk, they might not attain the end goal, but they give them a lottery ticket. Here, you won the award this week for taking a risk, or, you know, a stuffed giraffe because they stuck their neck out. And so you get the reward for sticking your neck out as opposed to shooting down the messenger. And, you know, yeah, I think that that's how we should start to look at this growth mindset instead of this fixed mindset that we've all been living towards. And I think going back, you know, will look different. And I love the fact that we can create a new normal. And whatever that looks like, I will say we went through a crisis, and we all collectively did. And anytime you have such a great transformation, while it's very painful, it does elicit the opportunity for new growth and a new way of being and coming together. But I think that we shouldn't forget the lessons that were good that we learned. Like, there have been so many studies done that showed instead of somebody having FaceTime and being at their desk, why don't we start measuring what they actually do accomplish, or what, or did they take a risk, or some of those things that really say so much more than just that you were at the office for 40 hours a week. Mm-hmm. Why don't you guys talk about how you think that this will be a period of innovation and what you think that might look like with this returning to work?
Yeah, lovely. You know, the first thing that we need to do is really honor the depth of the suffering and the grief we've all been through, because we can't just like show up all happy and yay, I'm back in the office, even though some people might feel that way. Mm-hmm. There's been such collective, just like you said, collective pain, grief. So we have to acknowledge that is in our being right now. And until we process and move through that, I mean, people are having challenges just showing up in groups or in, you know, reconnecting because we've been so shut off. I mean, the poor people who have, you know, I mean, we can list all the suffering. Yes. We don't, we all acknowledge that. So when we come back, acknowledge it. And this is such an important skill in life, balancing and holding the paradox of the suffering and the joy, the pain and the gifts. You know, it's not that you throw this all out, like this stuff happened. And now what do we reap and take? What is the goodness? What is the creation? What is the creativity that this time has forced us into exploring? It's not necessarily like remote work was unknown before this. I remember working on remote work organizational stuff in the 80s, but now it's so widely accepted in practice. And that transition, can we change? Can we change fast? Yeah, we can, because we had to. So right. Now, what does it tell us about our capacity, our resilience, our opportunity to really move ourselves forward and co-create solutions in more compelling ways that serve us? And not to forget, what do we really need individually, in groups, in families, in communities, as a human collective? Because now so much of our old ways have been stripped from us. It really allows us to start to prioritize the things that matter most. I think if anything, it allowed people to stand back and take pause and say, what do I really value? What matters most to me and my family and my children? And to the point of all of your work, dissolving the separation between work life and home life and whole life, because such a separation is a false narrative.
Right. And I think it's worth revisiting, because we evolve, we're going to be forever changed, as you mentioned. So really reevaluating, what is your purpose in life? What are your values that determine your purpose? Because they may look a little different. And how does that fit into your whole being as a whole person, so that we can move forward? But I think it will be very rewarding after this period of inquiry and opportunity, as you said, Laura, that it could be a very exciting time to bring forth those things that worked, those things that didn't. Flexibility does not mean working 24/7. So how does that look? Even if you come back to a hybrid or a very flexible work environment, how do we separate now that we know that, you know, you might have to move to a different room when you're working and shut the door? And how do you prevent yourself from running back in there at 8 o'clock at night when it might not serve you to do so?
Beautiful.
And we have a unique opportunity, certainly, and unique to our lifetime, in that everyone has been through this COVID experience together. Shared experience is really important for our ability to make connections to each other. We have been living in a very polarized environment, which makes some of this harder, but I hope that as people come back together, they will find an opportunity to find these shared experiences where they are able to connect with each other. And the beauty is we're going to be creating almost not from a truly blank slate, but from something of a blank slate. And I feel a strong desire out there to try to rebuild in a way that is responsive to what our experiences have been. So it's sort of like moving everything outside of your house, and you get to decide, okay, what are we going to move back in? Where are we going to put it?
And what brings us joy? I hadn't really made the connection to Marie Kondo. Like, right. What are the things that bring us joy? You know, where are the sparks of joy in life, across all of life? And what do we keep and what do we let go of? And this is just, I feel we're at the precipice of a huge period of growth and elevation and connection and human kindness, because we are all in a different state of awareness than we were a while ago.
Yeah, I like that. Marie Kondo, your life, you know, edit out what doesn't work for you, and bring in and keep the things that bring you joy. And I do think that, Evan, my hope is that even though people are polarized, that there's a basic agreement and a collective awareness that we all did go through something together that was extraordinarily hard. And so now the reopening or the coming back can be maybe to connect to someone who thinks very differently from you and see what the basic human connection needs are there. And, you know, it will create better home lives. It will create better work lives. It will create better leaders. You know, so I do think, Laura, we are at the precipice of a very new way where compassion isn't seen as a weakness, and it's really seen as a strength. We're talking so much more about mental wellness. That's going to be at the forefront because of the hardships that people have faced. So it is becoming so much more normalized. And so for really being able to look at someone else and see what they went through, what their experience is, will just deepen our bandwidth of and reservoir of empathy for someone else, and tools that we'll need to hone to help them while we help ourselves.
That's perfect. And what that sparks in my mind also is this opportunity for leaders to cultivate a new conversation with their organizations and teams. I think families have been sort of cultivating this new conversation as they've been moving through this. But leaders, now that you're talking about, is everybody coming back? Are some people going to be home? Is anybody going to be disadvantaged? What does disadvantage mean in this new era? You know, and how can leaders work in collaboration with their teams, asking them, what do they need? What will serve them? What will serve the group? What will serve the organization and the goals? So that, and at the end of the day, the leader makes the decision. Strong leaders are still strong leaders, but they're open, they're collaborative, they have their heart in the game, not just their head in the game, and they create the boundaries. Like, we do need guardrails, even as grownups, as you mentioned, like, how do we work? Well, mm-hmm. I'm going to set up a new environment with ground rules so we all know what's allowed, what we all created together. But when you get that buy-in, collaboration, people really feel a stake. They come back to a sense of engagement, mm-hmm. so much of which has been lost and very well documented, as you know, over the last 10 years at least.
Yes. Yeah, they need to have autonomy. And I think that we were, before the pandemic, certainly looking at employees in a very siloed, segregated way. So if they smoke, oh, let's throw a smoking cessation program at them. Or if they're overweight, let's get them an exercise bike or put a gym in our, you know, at our corporate headquarters and let them work out. When really, when the pandemic hit, they had to look at that whole person and all the things that were going on with them and their home life and how they were stressed out and what their kids needed and things that were, I think, much more relative to them as a whole person. So if we could do it then, why not bring that forth so that when somebody has a need at work, you can figure out with them, with the guardrails up, how within that can we work that out? Mm.
I'd love to think of guardrails more like little bumper things at the bowling alley. The big guardrails, you know, like at the side of a bridge. And if I don't make it over this little rope bridge, I'm going to plunge to my, you know, those bumper things are so relevant.
Yes. Well, this has been wonderful. Can you guys, just one of you, tell us where our listeners can find you and just an overview of what kind of things you offer to leaders quickly? And then, of course, I'll have everything in the notes.
You bet. Our website is at www.centerforcompassionateleadership.org. And under programs, you can see our current program offerings. We will be having 2 8-week trainings in the fall, and other offerings pop up all the time. While there, we would certainly encourage people to subscribe to our newsletter, which is which covers not just our offerings, but events and opportunities that are offered by others in the compassion and compassionate leadership fields.
As well as focusing on lots of research that goes on. Everything we do is evidence-based, and we love to continue, as you do, to come back to the science that informs what our hearts want, where our hearts want us to go. And then I would just pick up and talk about the community, because community and being in conversations like this with like-minded people who are all working to elevate the cause of common humanity and to do it in a way that enables us to all thrive is so lacking and so important. So we have channels on Twitter, mm-hmm. on Facebook, and Instagram at Being Compassion. although if you type in the center's name, we'll come up. And then also to please join us and follow us on LinkedIn. We do weekly polls now to get a sense and a feeling for where the community is in the ether and what ideas and thoughts are what issues are coming up for people, mm-hmm. you know, and we want to dig below the surface of, are you going back to work? Or are you not going back to work? Well, right. How do you feel about that?
Right. Right. Well, that's wonderful. I appreciate all that information. And I think I hear a perhaps part two of this podcast. I've appreciated so much the conversation and getting to know both of you. And I think maybe we should come back and talk about research and the evidence-based things. I'm reading Sanjay Gupta's book, Keep Sharp. And one of the biggest things he talks about is connection in your community. And so I think we could have a whole podcast on that. So I appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. And, you know, we appreciate what you do for everyone in our community.
Thank you, Cara.
Thank you, Cara. We appreciate you as well. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Mindfulness at Work. If you felt inspired by our conversation, we hope you'll share our podcast with your friends and colleagues.